scroll down, I'll show you.
Services. It's March 23rd. We have a public hearing on Senate Bill 5526, Oregon Health Authority. Ms. Ames, would you please start us?
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, today is the last day that we'll have with the addictions and mental health programs, and today will specifically be about the Oregon State Hospital. I also wanted to let you know, apparently there was a power outage and the Wi-Fi is not working quite right. And apparently you just have to reconnect. That it works, but you just have to reconnect to it.
For the state laptops, I think you have to restart.
But for I just reconnected.
Oh, okay, because I tried and it didn't work for me.
I had to restart.
And just for the record, I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
And that's it.
You do private.
I couldn't get mine to work.
My iPhone works.
Okay. We're ready.
If you can read that.
They've been doing some research.
If that makes any sense to you.
Hi, just remember to state your name first so we get it on the recording.
Yes. Good morning, Representative Nathanson, Senator Bates, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Greg Roberts. I'm the superintendent of the Oregon State Hospital.
Chairs Bates and Nathanson and committee members. For the record, my name is John Swanson. I'm the Chief Financial Officer at the Oregon State Hospital.
And also for the record, Kate Nass with the Department of Administrative Services.
She's always here. Who knows that, Madam Chair? Kate's always here.
So we're here this morning to talk about the Oregon State Hospital, and actually happy to do so. We think there's a great story to tell. Over the last 5 years, the hospital has gone through a tremendous transition, which I think is very positive. Not that the hospital is objectively the great hospital we aspire to be, but I think there's no doubt that we are a much better hospital serving our patients better than 5, 6, 10 years ago. So we begin with the slide that, we've organized our presentation to take a quick look back at, in a way, where recent problems began, 2006 visit to the hospital by the United States Department of Justice, where we were then, where we are currently, and where we continue to aspire to go. So we always begin with this slide to restate the mission of the hospital and the vision of the hospital and the mission of the hospital, because frankly, the work on the refocus on the mission of the hospital is where the transition of the hospital began. Several years of serious problems with the Department of Justice and with other accrediting agencies, we thought it was time to focus back on what's the mission of the hospital, why are we here, and basically to realize that if, to the extent that we do the job we're there to do, the problems with the United States Department of Justice and the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Hospitals and Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services go away because we're doing our job. So the mission of the hospital is to provide therapeutic, evidence-based, patient-centered treatment focused on recovery and community reintegration, and to do all that in a safe environment. And that mission is constantly on our mind. Confidently assert that if we were to go to the hospital right now and pull a random sample of staff and say, what's the mission of the state hospital, 90 to 95% of people could tell you what it is, which keeps us focused. We are the adult psychiatric hospital for the state. We provide intensive psychiatric treatment for people who are unable to be treated in community settings. In 2014, Blue Mountain Recovery Center, which closed in early 2014, and the state hospital cared for a total of 1,386 people who were, as I said, too ill or too dangerous to be served in the community. And as the top comment says we treat people who are civilly committed or criminally committed to the state hospital for treatment. We provide what's regarded as a hospital level of care, which is defined in the way you see on the slide, 24-hour nursing and psychiatric staff, on-site credentialed, organized medical staff. We provide treatment planning and treatment delivery. We have an on-site pharmacy, laboratory, on-site food and nutritional services, and with our emphasis on treatment, vocational and educational services as well. Our goal simply is to provide treatment so that people recover and return to life in the community. We treat four types of patients: those who are civilly committed, which includes people who are voluntarily committed by their guardian. And these are people who are significantly dangerous to themselves and other people by reason of their mental illness, and are unable to be treated in the community. We treat neuropsychiatric patients who are too often mislabeled as neurogeriatric. Only about half of this population is over the age of 65. These are people who have an organic brain injury, dementia, and very often have a significant mental medical illness as well. The third category of patients we treat are people who are guilty except for insanity. These are people who have been adjudicated, successfully pled the, in what in many states is called the insanity defense. And depending on the nature of their crime, people are either under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board — those are the major crimes, it's like considered tier one — or while they're in the state hospital, under the jurisdiction of the State Hospital Review Panel, or SHARP, and those are tier two, lower level crimes, but they are still people who have been adjudicated as guilty except for insanity. And then the fourth category of patients are what we refer to as the 370 patients. These are people who have been arrested in the community for a crime that may be minor or major, who are believed to be in the community, unable to participate in their defense, to aid and assist their defense attorney. And so they're sent to the state hospital for evaluation, confirmation of the inability to aid and assist in their defense, and then provided with treatment so that they understand the legal system, understand the charges against them, and can assist their attorneys in their defense.
Madam Chair, I had a question on the aid and assist group. How many of those individuals have a public defender versus those who have private counsel, number one? And you can get back that answer. On the aid and assist that's coming in, and how many of those are in the minority or colored category versus not? If you can get those stats back to me, I would appreciate it.
Right. Chairs Nathan Center Bates and Senator Winters would be happy to get
And I'm
that
sure you probably have a trend line of when you know, you begin to see the curve going up on aid and assist from a historical perspective.
Absolutely. So the next slide summarizes the census of the hospital for the biennium that began in July 2013. And actually, this is where the discussion certainly can begin about the 370 issue, which is a major issue for the hospital. When you look at a snapshot of the hospital, average census 608, in a snapshot look, 256 of those people would be guilty except for insanity. Only 156 would be 370, 139 would be civil, 51 would be neuropsychiatric, and then a small amount of others. But when you look at how many people have been admitted and discharged, you see the volume of the 370s jump off the page, in effect. So 685 of our 1,247 admissions during this time, 54%, almost 55%, were 370 patients, as well as 51 or 52% of our discharges. So while on the snapshot look, the largest number of people in the hospital are still the GEI patients, they account for only 8.5% of our admissions. So the turnover and the volume of work is in the 370 category.
How does Oregon's experience and median days at hospital for aid and assist compare to other states that might do something in a might have a similar process.
Representative Nathanson, if we don't have that data here and members of the committee, if we don't have that data in the slides coming up, we can get that for you, at least for the 15 Western states. We belong to what's called the Western State Psychiatric Hospital Association, WPSHA, and we collaboratively engage in data collection with them and comparative data for that.
Good.
But,
thank you.
But again, you see our median days, the median day for aid and assist patient is 71 days. So 50% of people stay longer, 50 stay 71 days, and not too many shorter than 70 or 71 days, but that is the median.
Thank you.
In terms of readmissions, which has come up as a question in the past, our rate of readmission is very low. Only 28 patients have been readmitted in the last 12 months, only 28 people have been readmitted within 180 days, 6 months of discharge. So the readmission, recidivism, is not a significant problem.
One of the reasons that, if I'm not mistaken, when Senator Bates and I were having some conversations with representatives of the hospital a couple of years ago, one of the potential reasons for readmission wasn't necessarily for a psychiatric reason. It was because someone in the community had a medical situation and there was not an appropriate place in the community to care for their medical needs as well as their psychiatric, so they had to be readmitted to the state hospital. Is that a possibility?
Chairs Nathanson and Bates, members of the committee, I would say no. I've been at the hospital now. This is my fifth year, and that has not come up as a significant problem. For a while, and not now, there was an issue with recidivism in the form of GEI patients who were being revoked, had violated some of the conditions of their release by the PSRB, and were sent back to the state hospital. And now there are opportunities in the community where the PSRB can keep that person in the community, move them to a more a higher level of restriction without returning them to the hospital, but not medical issues.
Thank you.
So in terms of taking a quick look back in terms of where the hospital was, it's as recently as 2005. Where the Oregonian printed a series of editorials, Senator Courtney toured the hospital. This is all before my time. I like to point that out. I'm still in New Jersey, but reading all about it. Significant problems at the hospital, crumbling infrastructure, older buildings, not a therapeutic environment for patients, a focus on the cremated remains, which comes up quite a bit and is absolutely, in my opinion, symbolic of a larger problem, that when cremated remains of people are in a storage shed and basically forgotten, it conveys an attitude of the importance of people with mental illness in general. The U.S. Department of Justice visited the hospital in 2006 and issued its findings in 2008. The U.S. Department of Justice focuses on a federal civil rights law. It's called CRIPA, Civil Rights of Institutionalized Persons Act. And so in the 40 states that they have visited, their findings for Oregon were similar but also very significant. They found an inadequate protection from harm from patients, which you see detailed here, a failure to provide adequate mental health care, inappropriate use of seclusion and restraint, inadequate nursing care in terms of numbers of people, but also performance issues, and inadequate discharge planning and placement in integrated settings in the community. And then a lesser well-known but important consultation. The hospital, after the U.S. Department of Justice came in 2006, issued its report in 2008, the hospital employed a number of consultant groups to study the hospital, to study the conditions, to make recommendations. And the Liberty Healthcare report of 2010, and you'll see at the bottom of the slide, Liberty Healthcare Corporation is an international consultant on comprehensive clinical programs and healthcare facilities, well-respected evaluators. So 4 years after the U.S. Department of Justice was at the hospital, the Liberty Healthcare consultants continued to find significant issues. There was compliance versus quality improvement was a confused concept, so it was called into question the hospital's performance, improvement activities, and outcomes. There's a famous line in that report that says, in its zeal to solve problems, the hospital took on too many problems and ended up solving none of those problems. So there was overflowing plates, and it wasn't for lack of effort, but there certainly was a lack of productivity. They noticed an absence of frontline engagement by cabinet members and leaders. There was an absence of clear and decisive authority. There was a proliferation of committees, I think 30-some committees at that time. Some were actually duplicative of each other, and there was a real confusion as to where committee recommendations would go for approval and action. The Health Information Group, basically the Medical Records Department and the Quality Management Department, were seen as disorganized and ineffective. Too many patients were being placed on one-to-one supervision, which then created a significant overtime problem, which is, those of you who were here at that time, a major portion of that problem was mandatory overtime, where I think a few thousand times a month staff might expect to be mandated to work overtime. And last, there was a perception that management could not dismiss poor performers. So we added this column for you to say resolve, 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 resolve. We can legitimately claim that each of these issues no longer exists at the hospital. The one-to-one issue we continue to work at. We keep our eye on that all the time in terms of how many patients are on one-to-one supervision and its relation to overtime. And others are also ongoing, as we'll see through the presentation.
Can I ask, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Mr. Roberts, one of the issues that came up in the 2013 session, if I'm remembering correctly, was a concern by some of the workers that when, in an attempt to reduce overtime, which is an admirable thing, especially mandatory overtime, that a lot of agency nurses and staff were being brought in, and there was some thought about creating a staff pool, you know, for on-call nurses, and that didn't move forward at that point. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how staffing has been adjusted so that the nurses and other staff who are on duty are people with a lot of experience with the state hospitals, so that they are able to easily fit into the routines, and how much you've had to depend on agency nurses and stuff to reduce overtime.
Sure. Chairs Nathanson and Bates and Senator Steiner Hayward and members of the committee. In a nutshell, I would say that overtime has been reduced at the hospital, which we'll see. Agency use has been reduced by two-thirds. We used to spend $3 million a year, now a million or slightly less. And in fact, in this year, our agency use would have been even less. But with the Portland facility closing, we wanted to make sure we maintain adequate staffing levels there in the event that staff began to depart Portland because they didn't want to transfer to Salem. But both overtime is down, mandatory overtime has nearly disappeared, and it's not because agency use is increased. We have created float pools. The issue 2 years ago was about creating full-time positions in a float pool, which we have not done. We've created limited duration positions and temporary positions in a float pool, which has also helped us reduce overtime while providing a consistent staffing. Because you're correct, agency staffing, unless they're coming regularly to the hospital, they may fill a need. If we bring in an agency RN, it covers the need for a licensed RN on the unit. But unless it's someone who works regularly at the hospital, it's not something we would want to do.
Quick follow-up, if I may, Madam Chair. Thank you. Mr. Roberts, thank you. That was very helpful. My only question about the temp positions that you're referring to is, how much of an issue is this in terms of people ending up not getting benefits because, and I apologize, I didn't know I was going to ask these questions in exactly this way, or I would have warned you. And you may not know the answer, but one of the concerns also 2 years ago when we were thinking about this float pool was people who ended up working there for a long period of time, but on temporary basis, and then didn't end up getting benefits and didn't end up getting permanent positions. And that was also a concern of frontline workers at the state hospital.
Representative Nathanson and Bates and Senator Steiner Hayward, we can get the data on that, because what's happened and helped quite a bit in the reduction of overtime and near elimination of mandatory overtime, we worked with SEIU to, one of the problems was that it took so long to fill a full-time vacancy because of required posting procedures, et cetera. So we reached an agreement with SEIU to significantly streamline the process by which positions are posted, people are selected, and a vacancy is filled. So there is a regular ongoing flow of people into full-time positions from the LD positions and then from the temp positions into LD positions where they do receive benefits. So we can get you the data on how long a typical temp remains a temp and moves into an LD position, but it's pretty quick. Sure.
Chairs and Senator Steiner Haywood, I would like to add too that in the 2015-17 governor's budget, those positions have been made into full-time permanent positions.
Great. Thank you very much.
53 positions.
Right? 53 Excellent. Positions.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Okay. So again, quickly going through the timeline, back in 2005, we felt it was important to go through the look back quickly as we can, just to remember that it really was not that long ago that this was a problem. This was a hospital with very significant problems, and we think we've come quite far in a five-year period. So back in 2005 was the issuance of the Oregon State Hospital Master Plan that included, among other things, the approval for a new hospital in Salem and the construction of the hospital in Junction City. The legislature approved the Salem and Junction City funding in 2007. In between then, 2006, the hospital, moving toward its mission of providing treatment leading to discharge, opened its first treatment malls. 2008 were the findings of the U.S. DOJ. 2010 was the Liberty Healthcare report. Then the Excellence Project began, which I'll talk about in a minute. In 2011, the first building of the new hospital was ready for occupancy, and we moved our first patients in there in January 2011. Then by 2012, with the incremental building of the new hospital, by 2012, I think it was the summer of 2012, all of the patients were in the new hospital, and the old hospital across Center Street was vacant. And then just March 11th of this year, Junction City campus opened with a capacity of 75 patients. The Excellence Project was the consultant group, Kaufman Global, was approximately a year at the hospital to address the ongoing issues of the U.S. Department of Justice and the Liberty Healthcare report. But this was a significant group. The Kaufman Global is a worldwide company, focuses on lean methodology, problem solving, and these were the specific targets of their contract to address the hospital's norms, basically to help achieve an organizational culture change.
Senator Bates.
Yes.
Just a quick question and give the information to us later. Do you have the same kind of data on the patients at Junction City as you have at the Salem Center?
Representative Nathan, Senator Bates, yes. Yes, we keep the data exactly the same. Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And I know we'll be coming to a pretty robust discussion about
thank you.
Some of that. Right, so these were the specific goals of the Kaufman Global consultation. And again, we can legitimately point out that all of those recommendations have been carried out and have been carried out now for several years. So I would say by 2011, 2012, they were well in place and they're ongoing.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Winters.
Somewhere, and you probably don't have it, but I know Mr. Swanson probably does. Do we have a total cost of what it's cost us, our total investment from start to finish on this project? and I mean from the, when we started in 2005 when the trigger was pulled, and by the way, there were some members on this panel that are not here, Senator Gordley and others that were involved in some of this. So do you have what the overall has cost us, Mr. Swanson?
Chairs and Senator Winters, I can get the exact amount. You're talking about the replacement project that included everything. I believe it was about $500 million, but I want to confirm that.
Okay.
I can get that for you.
Thank you.
That's including construction.
That includes construction and all the other elements that went into that project.
Representative Boone.
Thank you. So I have, back in the day, in 2005, I was on the master plan task force, and one of the things that came up that we were going to do, I thought, was have some community units that would be in permutations of eight, like eight units or 16 or whatever. And I'm wondering what happened to those. I know they were. We talked about having some at the coast and some far east in the state, and I don't see them anywhere now. I know that was a different discussion when they split the big hospital into the two, but. Is that still part of the plan, or has the plan changed to not have these smaller community-centered locations?
Chairs Basin Nathanson and Representative Boone, there's been, while the hospital has been transitioning in Salem, now Junction City, there's also been a fairly robust expansion of community programs of all type, so I'm not specifically familiar with the 8 or 16 bed programs. I know PSRB through the few years has opened a number of programs in the community that along those lines as well, but I don't have the specifics about those.
Follow up?
Yes.
Are there any at the coast or planned for the coast?
Honestly, I'm not familiar enough with the community system to answer.
Okay.
Knowledgeably.
Senator Winters.
Yes, just to follow up on Representative Boone's question, and maybe it is time, Madam Chair, that we have that discussion. She's correct. We did talk about the 16-bed facilities, not only within the community, but also it is a it allows us to actually do a better job of leveraging dollars. Because 16 beds are not treated with our match as an institution where Junction City and the State Hospital and others are. And so it may be well for this body to begin our talk about, and I know that this good senator actually was very, very much an advocate for community-based facilities around the state. And I know, you know, I was involved with Governor Kulongoski when he started the conversation back when he was governor. So it's been a lot of years that we've actually talked about, you know, siting. And, you know, I'd make the comment maybe because of not in my neighborhood issue that it may be well that we may have to have siting authority to do some of this. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Secretary, Senate.
You're going to send me back to Washington? Is that what
you thought about it just for a minute.
It'd be improving.
So in our next slide, we talk about our treatment models, and I know a number of members of the committee have been out to the hospital. You've seen the treatment models in operation, and we emphasize them because of the importance of the concept. Patients come to the state hospital for treatment, whether they are civilly committed or 370s or GEI or neuropsychiatric. All of our patients are there to be treated. They receive most of their treatment in our treatment malls, and you've seen these. They are centralized places throughout the hospital. We have six operating now, and six in Salem, two in Junction City. And patients, whereas 5 or 10 years ago, patients, not only in Oregon State Hospital, but many across the country, patients were allowed to be in day rooms all day watching television or just not engaged in treatment. But patients come to the hospital for treatment, and the treatment should lead to discharge. So we have robust programs in our treatment malls. Our our general goal is 20 hours of active treatment a week, meaning it's derived from the patient's treatment plan. Some patients attend much more than 20 hours, and some attend less because they're not, their clinical condition does not permit them to go to the mall. They may be newly admitted or otherwise unstable, but that's a small percentage of our patient population. They generally go 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours in the afternoon, and now we have expanded into evening hours as well. So it's like going to work or going to school. The groups we provide are, there's very good input by patients into what the groups need to be. We look to match up the group, what we provide in groups should be derived from patients' treatment plans. So the malls run on 10 or 11 week semesters and then have a break, which happens to be this week to coincide with spring break. And they assess the programs that we just provided in the previous semester, get patient input, and then revise our program provision accordingly. So about 75% of our patients attend at least 20 hours a week of programming, and 95% of those who attend the malls actively participate in their groups. That's, and those are much higher figures than I know other hospitals across the country report. Personally, I know from my experiences in other places, the reason those numbers are so high, in my opinion, is because of the patient input into what we provide. Other hospitals often, the staff decide it would be nice to provide this type of group where this would be an interesting thing to do. But if the patients are not interested in the program you're providing, they're not going to attend the mall. So since we're constantly getting patient feedback and input on the programs we provide, I think that's one of the reasons why the attendance figures are so high for us. The treatment mall groups also include vocational rehabilitation. A number of our patients are very high functioning and capable of work when they leave the hospital, so we have vocational opportunities in the hospital. We have patients working in food service. We have them making the Adirondack furniture that's a bit famous for, and they're in the groundskeeping department. We provide supported education. We have patients who receive their GED while they're in the hospital, and we even now have patients taking online college courses. We provide art therapy, music therapy, mindfulness, yoga. We have increasing amounts of peer-delivered services. We focus on co-occurring disorders for people who have a substance abuse problem, which is 80% of our population. For the 370 patients, we emphasize legal skills. Dual diagnosis programming refers to people who have a developmental disability diagnosis in addition to their mental illness. And we have patients who volunteer in the community at such places as Habitat for Humanity and the animal shelter as well. So, pretty robust array of services. In terms of the performance system, and I want, I did not select this picture, so. In fact, I tried to get it off the slide, but I couldn't. But this, because one of the issues at the hospital, one of the major issues at the hospital back in 2009 or 2010, was nothing much was getting resolved. It speaks to your performance improvement system. Lots of problems at the hospital, lots of effort, probably taking on too many things at once was part of it. And also part of it back then was an inability to base decisions on reliable data, which is not a problem for the hospital now in 2015. We have instituted and now very, very much enculturated lean methodology into our problem-solving approaches. Lean, in a nutshell, is designed to do what the word implies. To be lean means to eliminate waste, yeah, which can be time, it can be money, it can be people making errors, low productivity, too much bureaucracy, and things that get in the way of fixing whatever the problem happens to be. And it relies on the people closest to the problem to resolve the problem. We have a regular series of ongoing, what we call rapid process improvement initiatives or work team initiatives, where the people who are closest to the issue we're looking at are engaged in an analysis of the problem and then a solution of the problem. So that not only gives us a better understanding of what is causing the problem, but to the extent that people at lower levels of the organization are involved in the solution, then there's a very high likelihood that the solution will be applied and will endure through time, as opposed to a top-down management structure where leaders of the hospital would indicate this is what you need to do to solve the problem. It may solve the problem, but it won't endure. In terms of lean daily management system, this is where each of the patient units and then various departments around the hospital have what's called a primary visual display board, PVD board. This is what one looks like. They're collecting data on the metrics that have been selected. On the units now, we're looking at seclusion use, restraint use, aggression, mall attendance. Some of the geriatric units are looking at falls and things like this. They collect data every day. They have what are called huddles on each shift, looking at how the performance is going and reacting accordingly. We had 54 lean projects completed since 2011, and we can detail those for you if you would like. 29 are currently in progress. So that's where we have been. Where we are now, the overhead view of the Salem Hospital and then the Junction City facility. And in the last biennium, as we mentioned, the Blue Mountain Recovery Center in Pendleton closed in March 2014. All of their patients and all of their capacity transferred to Salem. Required us to open two additional units, which had been closed prior to that, and increased our daily population by 55 patients. Junction City opened in March 11th, only a few weeks ago. We opened three. There are six 25-bed units there. We opened three. They have the capacity to serve 75 people, and in the 2015-2017 governor's budget, recommendation is to open a fourth unit and have the capacity to serve 100 people. With Junction City opening, we're closing our Portland facility on March 31st, a week from tomorrow, and the three units that were at Salem just left and occupied Junction City, and they will be replaced by three units from Portland next week. All the staff, all the patients are relocated in their entirety, so they're all of the staff, all of the patients from three units in Salem on March 11th went in their entirety to Junction City. So there's no new learning curve, same staff working with the same patients in the same environment.
That must have been interesting.
Senator Bates and members of the committee, it was smooth as silk. Since 2011, and we just talked about this among the staff last week, since 2011 there has been constant change at the hospital, opening the new hospital incrementally from 2011 to 2012, a period of calm, then closing Blue Mountain, opening units in Portland, now opening Junction City, closing Portland. And once Portland is down in Salem next week, there are no more major moves planned, and as you'll see, we'll be focusing on quality of care and treatment even more earnestly than we're already doing. So,
Representative Kenny Gallier.
Thank you. Just so I can understand clearly, over the last few years, we're increasing capacity by 100 people. Is that 100 patients?
Chairs Bates and Nathanson and Representative Kenny Gallier, no. The capacity remains nearly exactly the same. Actually, I think a few less than five beds less, but the capacity remains about the same.
Senator Winters.
Madam Chair, just to add some context, and the capacity didn't change, and that just reinforced the conversation that Representative Boone had earlier, because if you look at some of the plan and the hopefulness of some members of this panel, that it was hoped that we would also actually expand capacity by having community residential facilities. So, the picture isn't complete. We're just talking about Salem and Junction City. in my own little limited world.
Right.
Well, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Bates.
I have this vision of buses leaving after midnight, you know, kind of sliding down the freeway, trying to avoid everybody seeing what's going on. But I appreciate it's a hard transition. You've done a good job. The fact that I didn't get any phone calls means you did a good job. So thumbs up. Nicely done. My biggest concern here, and we're going to talk about some of these censuses. These are very expensive ways of taking care of patients that for many times I'm sure is inappropriate. We should have them in community areas. You're trying to make it move that direction. I always found it interesting that when they put together the master plan, I specifically asked to be on that as the only physician in the building, and I was specifically asked not to be on it because they knew my position. My position was we don't open up Junction City, we get people out of this hospital and develop the community beds we really need. So I was also worried that someday I'd be sitting here as chair of this committee trying to make the budget work. And here it is, okay? Thank you very much. One of the things that's happened has helped us is that you clean up the state hospital, and I appreciate the work you've done. It's not perfect. It never will be perfect out there. You're dealing with very difficult people. But I would still like to see us get that census down. It would warm my heart to see Junction City closed down, and we use that for geriatrics for corrections and not being used as a state hospital anymore. Anyway, the question I'm getting to here, when they were billing Junction City, they told me that if we ever got to the point where we started be in a position where we develop good community programs, that could be used for corrections, our elderly people in corrections. Do you think, looking at that building, that is a possibility?
Chairs Nathanson and Bates and Senator Bates, I absolutely do.
Good.
Again, it's before my time, but I've done as much reading as I can. The original master plan for Junction City, I think, called for 300-some beds there. And a few years ago, as the community system was expanding, that was reevaluated, and the capacity of Junction City was significantly reduced to 174. And it's my understanding back when the legislature was approving the funding for Junction City that those comments were made, that as the community mental health system continues to evolve and expand, the day will come sooner rather than later, I think, to say that Junction City would no longer be necessary as a psychiatric hospital and the beds in Salem would be sufficient to serve the necessary population. So that's...
Thank you.
That's the goal.
Thank you.
So after all the moves are done and the dust is settling, the Salem campus becomes it has a capacity for 24 units. The governor's budget has the funding for operating 23, also six cottages and up to 620 patients. But with the one unit closed, we would be serving up to 594 patients. Now the questions will be coming, and we expect to be ready. These are the census trends. So this is the total population trend from January 2010. We're looking at a five-year period. So the total census of the hospital went from 649 to 594 in December 2014. It's about the same currently. So a decrease of 50 or so in the total population. The interesting thing, and I think unforeseen trend, is the next slide. The guilty except for insanity population in this five-year period has decreased from 339 to 236. Steady downward trend, which I'm not sure that the master plan planners foresaw. There's been some changes, again, an expansion of community provision of care for people who are GEI, and some changes in the law. Senate Bill 420, which created the two tiers of GEI patients, and significant. Many, many more people under PSRB jurisdiction are now in the community than in the state hospital.
Right. So. Couple of things, Madam Chair, and it would be helpful because you referenced Senate Bill 420, which I hopefully did have an impact. But also, if you could break out for us and give us back you know, the changes that occur and give them to us by county, that gives us a actual a picture of which counties actually are being more of a participant and PSRB and their work and how they're handing off. Because, you know, those, the individuals actually, most of them will go back to the county of jurisdiction. So that would be very helpful to see what's occurring and what the county relationships are in this particular issue. Sure.
Chair, is Nathan Senator Bates and Senator Winters, we can certainly get that information.
So it's working. Madam Chair. Yeah. This is very encouraging. I'd like also, besides what Senator Winters asked for, I'd like to know how many of these patients have been placed out in the community have reoffended or come back into the system, and that means gone into corrections also versus coming into state hospital. I want to make sure that our program's working. You know?
Representative Nathan, Senator Bates, we have that data. I can tell you off the top of my head, it's very few, I think less than a dozen people who have reoffended and ended up in a correctional facility. Or,
thank you. Yeah. I'd like to know the follow-up.
Yes.
I'd like to know how serious those reoffenses were. Okay, if this, if everybody, we don't want to put the public at risk with this.
Correct.
But I do believe you're moving in the right direction. But it's some tough decisions. These people can be unpredictable. You know, make sure they're taking their medications, all the things we know about. But I'd like to see some information on that. And, but I think overall, obviously, this is the right thing to be doing, and I appreciate your efforts.
Sure. Representative Nathan, Senator Bates, the just to be clear, when most people leave the state hospital, they remain under PSRB jurisdiction
right,
in the community. They often have conditions of release. That's the revocation process I talked about earlier. And so even revocations have decreased. And part of it, I know that PSRB will be appearing before the committee soon. But I know that they've also done a good job of expanding their community services, and the results speak for themselves.
Madam Chair, also a part of that conversation, because I was on the committee, part of that conversation is whether or not we could actually have both entities working together to help facilitate this and make it a very smooth transition. Or, and that was the role that the Oregon State Hospital would play with PSRB, if you recall all these discussions,
right.
And whether that handoff would be a smooth transition. So,
sure.
So that's... PSRB was one piece, you hospital was another piece, and whether or not we could bring the two together for the recommendation for sending people back in the community, whether they were fit or not, and what obstacles. So I think we're all interested in see what, if there were returns, what were they?
Chairs Nathan, Senator Bates, and Senator Winters, I'm happy to say the from the beginning, the State Hospital Review Panel, SHARP panel that deals with the Tier 2 offenders, the structure and process is the same as PSRB. The only difference is the level of offense they're looking at. And there is good collaboration between the two from the beginning. There are no issues there. In fact, I think as one panel... would look at a case and feel comfortable discharging the person to the community, the other panel felt the same, and we haven't seen any difference of opinion where PSRB feels people should be in the state hospital and a SHARP panel thinks people should be out. I think the decision making is basically the same.
So.
Good. Ms. Ames, could you please remind us of our schedule?
Madam Chair, PSRB will actually be here tomorrow, and so that was our idea, is there was going to be a lot of overlap between these programs, and it'll all be fresh in your mind.
Thank you.
Okay, the next slide shows the trend, five-year trend of civil population. The only reason it's increased is the closure of Blue Mountain. This is the Salem census. So if from the beginning you added 50 or 55 patients to the numbers, it's a pretty flat line. Generally, the civil patients, the civil beds tend to be filled all the time, so the census reflects the capacity of the beds.
So, Madam Chair, may I?
Yes.
So, I am just kind of curious, Greg, are we saving any money with having closed Blue Mountain?
Chairs Nathan, Senator Bates, and Representative Olson, I'm going to look to my right and ask Mr. Swanson.
Hey, is that a, it's like a good question,
yeah,
isn't
yeah,
it? I
mean,
I don't think we should.
Co-chairs and Representative Olson, that is a good question. I guess if you look at our total budget, I would have to say no, because our total budget is actually increasing still again, because the settings that we've created in Junction City, I think, are much better, much more therapeutic, and more expensive. So it's not that we are saving any money by closing Blue Mountain and moving them to a different setting.
So follow up with that, Madam Chair. Any ballpark idea of how much money we're losing as a result of that?
Let me tell Chair Nathan
Bateson. I'm going to ask you to also, it's an interesting way to ask the question, but there also would have been enormous costs to bring the Blue Mountain facility up to standards.
Yes, exactly.
So how would we factor that
right.
in?
Right.
It's, if we had not done this, then we would have done something else.
Chairs Nathan and Bates and Representative Olson, actually, that's exactly true. Mm-hmm. The comparison I recall being done, I think the first year I was here, was the comparison of operating Salem and Junction City compared to Salem and Blue Mountain. And when you raised the, to do an apples-to-apples comparison to compare the staffing levels and issues in Blue Mountain compared to Salem and Junction City, as I recall then, it was about an $11 million difference, which represented the fact that I think that Blue Mountain was a pretty inadequately staffed facility, and Junction City is not. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. The aid and assist population is the next slide. So the increase over the five-year period.
I want to do a time check. Are we, let's see, we're about two-thirds done with the slides, right?
Yes.
We have time for one more question here.
Sure.
The civil?
Yes.
There's a slight upward trend here against state population. I'm guessing that's probably close to state population trending. These are people who really do need to be in this hospital. We can't seem to deal with their behaviors locally at local institutions. Do you have any feel about this? These are people usually pretty demented, who are acting out, angry, disordered time, place, and person. Are these people, as the population increasing, can we place more of them in local facilities? Can some of our local nursing homes be converted to dementia wards? If those kind of conversations going on?
Chairs Nathan Senator Bates and Senator Bates, yes. In fact, in the past biennium, we did close one of our neurogeriatric wards by placing people sufficiently in community beds, and now we have, I would say on an average day, we have five or six empty vacant neurogeriatric beds in the hospital. But the civil population also includes younger people that I do think speaks to community capacity. We are the money that's in the budget to continue to expand the community system, and some changes we're looking to make and we'll get to this when we talk about the 370 population. There's an interconnection between the two so that there can be a better flow in the system. Right now there are 20 people on a waiting list for Oregon State Hospital placement, civil patients. They are in inpatient units waiting for a bed to open at the hospital so we can admit them. And that forces people back into, that's the psychiatric boarding problem, where then people who are waiting in the emergency rooms to get into the inpatient unit, while people in the inpatient unit are waiting for the state hospital, while we have people at the state hospital who are waiting for community placement. So community is the answer to those problems. To the extent that we can discharge people who are ready to place, we can bring in people from the inpatient units and therefore get people out of the emergency rooms. That's our plan.
And at a later time, we'll talk about the Alameda model. It's going to be pioneered up in Multnomah County, which may eliminate the entire problem if it's successful. Mm-hmm. I have concerns about whether they actually pull off what they're going to say they're going to do, but we'll talk about it.
Okay. We see it as a front door, back door issue. We have people ready to be discharged, and we have people whose admission could be avoided, likely, if there were additional services in the community. So we're working on front door and back door issues.
Great.
So then we come to the all good news so far. GEI population significantly down, civil patients flat. Aid and assist population is the issue. Over the past 5 years, an increase of average of 90 370 patients in the hospital, now 151. It's even higher than that today, 158. And these are people who are arrested in the community, for major or minor crimes who are then sent to the state hospital to be restored to the ability to aid and assist. All 370 admissions represent 60% of all admissions to the state hospital, and 40% of that number are arrested for a misdemeanor. And we began to raise this issue about 2 years ago, but we've been doing some work on it, but the problem continues. So there are some bills in the hopper to be looking at, especially the misdemeanor population and programs. This is where we're going to be talking about the Marion County success story with avoiding the admission of 370 misdemeanors to the hospital, but with also without arresting them in the community, which is the ultimate goal. So nationally, this is a problem called criminalization of the mentally ill. You have people who are mentally ill creating some type of issue in the community, but they don't meet the involuntary commitment standard. So they can't be civilly committed to the state hospital. They have problematic behavior, but they're not so dangerous to themselves or others as to meet the involuntary commitment requirement. So what often happens, again, not just in Oregon, but across the country, people are arrested, even for a minor crime, and then sent to the state hospital for the treatment that we believe could be provided in the community, but it doesn't exist or it doesn't exist in sufficient quantity.
Oh, yeah.
Representatives.
So, Greg, do you have any stats on how many folks right now are in that population of 370 that have committed a misdemeanor? Well, I'll say just a C or a B misdemeanor rather than the A.
We have provided, you should have the chart from this morning. It's, as a general statement, it's 40% of all the 370 patients in the hospital are misdemeanors.
So you're talking A through C misdemeanors?
Yes.
And the majority of them are they A misdemeanors then? Does it follow?
Yes, the largest number is A misdemeanors.
Okay, yes. Follow up, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Do you have any information on how many of those A misdemeanors started out as a felony?
Chairs Nathanson and Bates and Representative Olson, none.
Really?
Did. These are, when we represent this data, this is the highest level of crime the person has. So if someone was arrested for a felony, they're shown as a felony, even if they have an additional misdemeanor charge. So these are the highest level of offense that brought them to the hospital as a misdemeanor.
Okay, thank you.
Madam, I'm sorry. Yes. Senator Bates ahead of me.
There we go. No, anyway.
Mr. Roberts, if this isn't the right time to talk about this, I'm looking with great interest at this chart. Are you planning to address this in more detail sooner, or would you rather have a question now?
Now is fine.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
I'm really puzzled by the variability in this. And obviously, highlighting what Marion County is doing is really great, and I think they're doing some really interesting things. But if you look at Klamath and Tillamook counties, they're down 40%. Now, they have much smaller populations. But Multnomah County is down almost 19% as well over that period. And I'm wondering, is it an issue of a program that Multnomah County is doing in the very small counties? Is it that people are still incarcerated for some reason, or that they've finally gotten the help they need? Help me, if you could, if you know the answer. If you don't, then we can look forward to a response at some point about why there's so much variability here, why we have some counties going up significantly and some going down a lot.
Chairs Nathanson and Bates and Senator Hayward. Just to explain, the percentage changes are based on the average, the admissions per month, because the second column is only a 9-month period compared to a 12. So
yeah, but an admissions per month is stays the same no matter. I'm sorry, Matt.
Right.
it stays the same no matter what period you cover, right?
Correct. I'm just trying to make sure we understand. So I don't have any hard information about that other than there are, we've been talking quite a bit with our community partners on this. I know Multnomah County has developed some, I don't think they're calling it a mobile crisis team, but it's similar to that. So there's a lot of effort being expended throughout the state in Multnomah County, Marion County, some other places that may be beginning to affect these numbers, but it's what it's demonstrating is what we're saying is that people, especially misdemeanants, perhaps can be more appropriately treated in the community without being arrested.
Which I would certainly agree with. I'd be interested to see more about that at your convenience. Thank you.
I would like to make sure that this panel has time to complete the rest of the information they need to share with us today. If you can stand going uninterrupted, if your voice will hold out, I'd like to ask you to complete your presentation. We will hold our questions and write notes about which slides we want to go back to ask questions if there's time at the end.
Chairs Nathanson and Bates, I'm Irish, so I can talk all day. yes, and so we provided, Senator Winters had raised some issues last week about the data for 370, so we presented it in quite a bit of detail comparing felonies, aid and assist, and various points in time. So if I can just take a minute to talk about the Marion County work, the hospital worked with Marion County officials for the past year at least on this issue, and the work group included judges, defense attorneys, disability rights organizations, I would say all the correct stakeholders that need to be in the discussion. And Marion County, the work in Marion County, I would say, has demonstrated what we hoped could be demonstrated, that with mental health practitioners linking with the police on mobile crisis calls, intervening with people with mental illness, and having the access to a fairly robust community system of care, including a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week crisis center, we've been able to influence the number in Marion County downward. As I said in another panel last week, it may not look significant. It's a 1.8. The average now is 1.8 compared to a 3.3. But that's about two people fewer per month. Over the course of a year, that's 24 fewer misdemeanor 370 patients coming into the hospital from Marion County. And so if that were to be replicated across the state in the counties that send the most 370 misdemeanors to the hospital, then we would be able to have a discussion about changing the curve, where that steady upward line being able to influence that downward. So, but it's a wonderful project. The stakeholders worked well together, very collaboratively. The sheriff's office, the mental health providers in Marion County, it's been great. So, speaking of which, now I get to be quiet for a few minutes, and Mr. Swanson will handle the budget slides. So,
thanks, Greg. Co-chairs Bates and Nathanson and committee members, I'm going to run through the governor's budget, and first slide you'll see there is looks at our funding. Combined with Junction City for next biennium, the total budget's $493.4 million. And I just, out of curiosity, went back yesterday and looked at what that number was back where we started at the front of this book when we had a number of issues to deal with, and it was $199.1 million, so less than half of what we're spending now, back in 2005-07. As you'll see there, and has always been the case that I've been involved with the hospital, the vast majority of our funding is state general fund. Only about 14% comes from other and federal fund dollars. Of that, the biggest part of it is called disproportionate share hospital, which is Medicaid funding to help cover some of the costs of indigent care of our patients. We also have a piece that's called designated state health program. It's about three points of that 14%, and basically that is additional federal dollars that the state received a few years ago when some of the previously fully state-funded programs were deemed eligible for match. And the federal dollars that was gleaned from that offset a portion of the general fund need. So we received about $16 million, I think, from this designated state health program. And I mention that because you'll see that in the expenditure side, too, and I'll get to that in a minute. And about four and a half points of that 14 come from all the rest of the Medicaid and Medicare funding that we currently receive. The rest come from some private pay insurance and patient pay. They're by law required to bill for a cost of care for all of our patients in the hospital and then adjust that to an ability to pay and actively try to collect that. I would want to say that we have been actively looking at the federal dollars, federal and other fund dollars that may be eligible to our hospital for our patients' cost of care. And I've been at the hospital now for about 10 months, and that's one of my been my major focus to try to see if we can increase that. And I believe we can. We've got a number of things that we need to do in order to accomplish that, and I'll probably be talking more about that next time we meet. The next slide looks at the expenditure side for the hospital, and as you might guess,
I think that's the right one.
Yes. Most of the costs of the hospital are for people. Salaries, taxes, and benefits, about 80% of our budget. $65 million, or about 15% of our budget, is for what service and supplies. And I have a slide in a minute that I want to make a point around that because it's not the typical state agency service and supplies you might think of. And then, as I said, about $16 million. Is an expenditure for the other side of that designated state health program. The federal dollars that we received relieve the need for some of the general fund, and we transfer that general fund over to OHA Division of Medical Assistance Plans as part of their funding that they can use for the Medicaid program. This is Salem, about $416 million in Salem campus for next year. About 16 of that's the designated state health program. So the actual operations of the hospital is about $400 million for the biennium. The next slide, similar proportions for Junction City. And again, this is a new entity that we've just opened. So we're still learning about what their expenditure patterns are going to be. But this is our best estimate for next year. And then my point around the next slide on the service and supplies, when you look at those items at the state hospital, the majority of those, about 85% of them, are what I would consider direct care costs for our patients. They're things like food for our patients, medications for our patients, contracted professional services for our patients, health care needs. If somebody becomes sick or injured at the hospital, we typically have to transport them to the Salem Hospital for care, and we pay the Salem Hospital the Medicaid rate, but there's still a cost for that. So about 15% of the indirect or of the service and supplies would be what I would consider indirect costs, and that's kind of the more typical things you might think of with state agencies. And the point I make here is when there's across the board decisions to reduce that administrative S&S, it's very difficult for the state hospital to accomplish that and maintain a budget to fund the things we need to take care of our patients. Are there any questions on that part? And I'll move on to... you're not doing questions, sorry.
Right.
There probably are.
I want to make sure that we get through the end of the presentation first.
Right. Okay, I'll direct your attention. We did talk a little bit about overtime, and the majority of our overtime is in direct care. So you have nursing overtime. And what we've done is put this into an average per patient because we tried to normalize it with the inflow of additional patients from the Blue Mountain Recovery Center. The actual dollars are pretty much down slightly, not as dramatic as this, but when you consider that we have more patients that we're caring for, looking at it on an average, we thought would give an indication of how we're doing on that. Just to put that into a little context, the WPSHA papers that Greg mentioned were part of that association. We did a survey of what percentage of total salaries and benefits that overtime represents at those Western state psychiatric hospitals. The average of those was 7.5% of their cost. Ours is about 4.9. So while it's significant here, it's not out of line with what you see at other hospitals. And I will say, just to give you some context in terms of the total hours, I went back and looked in state fiscal years 11 and 12, and we were running over 36,000 hours in a month of overtime, and we brought that down to under 20. Made some progress, still have significant hours that we're working on. There's been a lot of effort put into that, still more to come. The next slide is the one we mentioned earlier around the nurse agency expenditures, and it's really not an issue for us at this time at the hospital. It's fairly minimal and usually under what we planned on it at this point, at least. Little spikes there for certain kinds of coverages, particularly around holidays and training periods.
Vacation.
That concludes my part.
If I could just mention on the overtime, the slide that showed the average per patient, it was difficult. We'd be happy to present the information in any way the committee would like, but with units opening, closing, Blue Mountain moving over, we struggled to see what would be a presentable way for the data. So if this is basically the overtime divided by the census. So it gives you a per patient, given how many patients are in the hospital, it gives you that comparison. But if you'd like to see the data some other way, we struggled to do it. I think the salient point is what John said. Of the 15 Western state hospitals, we use the smallest percentage of our budget for overtime now, and we have reduced it pretty significantly. Talk about lean methodology again, and I know some of you have been out to the hospital to see this. We collect data daily. We have a daily meeting. We meet with our nurse supervisors. We look to understand every hour of overtime, and it's had a good effect of reduction, and we believe there's more that we can do. So then on to one of the issues that we always want to talk about is patient aggression, patient-to-staff aggression. And I always want to lead this off because of the stigma that's attached to mental illness. 84% of our patients last year had not a single act of aggression. 2.7% of our patients account for nearly half of the aggression in the hospital. So it's a small percentage of our patients who are significantly aggressive. And many of them, it's at the point of their admission until they are stabilized and treated in some way, then they're somewhat unstable people. To put it in context, these are staff injuries related to patient aggression. In 2012, there were 157, 2013, 140, and in 2014, only 115. So a good reduction there as well. There's a reduction in the numbers as well as the degree of injury suffered as a result of the patient-to-staff assault, although personally I don't love the word assault. It's an act of aggression between a staff member by a patient. And then, so we're looking here on this slide at the number of lost days, workers' compensation claims that related to patient assault. The data looks more significant than it will turn out to be because this is an ongoing topic. There's one person, for example, who was injured in 2012 who is now back at work but on light duty. So the numbers for 2012 may continue to change as that person accumulates lost work days. But the trend is very much in the direction we like to see. The number of lost work days has come significantly down along with the associated costs. But we need to understand that the numbers, even for 2014 especially, will continue to change as there are some people injured in 2014 who are still either out of work or on light duty. So. In terms of the WPCHA data, the comparison is we're about in the middle of the WPCHA group in terms of level of aggression, rates of aggression toward staff by patients. And then a very brief look at, so far then we've talked about where the hospital has been, where we are now where we are going. As I said in my introduction, there's no doubt that the Oregon State Hospital is a much better hospital than 5 and 6 years ago, and not just because of a new building, but because of a focus on the basic mission of the hospital and a significant investment in treatment opportunities. So we continue to strive. Our goal is actually to be the best state psychiatric hospital in the United States, and there's a good chance that we are already. We've been visited by a number of states around the country. We hosted the WPCHA conference last year. The 15 states came and visited the hospital, took a tour, and left very very impressed. But we focus on the principle of recovery. There's a belief, an absolute confidence now that people, even with severe persistent mental illness, can recover and should live in the community, not spending their life in a state psychiatric hospital, as they did at the beginning of my career in the early 70s. So we focus on all of these issues. This is the SAMHSA definition of recovery, and we try to focus on all these things. We're doing well. We're moving in a good direction, but we have a lot more to do, especially in trauma-informed care and peer-centered treatment, where the patients basically write their own treatment plan. They tell us what their hopes, their aspirations are, what they expect to do when they leave the hospital, and the treatment plan is focused on getting to that point. These are some of the areas we're focusing on, and I should say, and we talked about this 2 years ago, that in terms of safety, when we talked about patient to staff aggression, worker injuries, lost time, etc., there was too much of a sentiment at the hospital that it was a numbers issue, that we needed more staff to be safer. And if we replayed the tape from 2 years ago, we said that isn't true. The issue is training. The issue is competency of the staff. It doesn't matter to add 100 more staff if they're no more competent to be able to do the job. So we have focused tremendously in this biennium on training, especially the direct care staff, in some safe containment that you see listed there is a homegrown product where our own staff developed a training program for how to be safe when you need to physically intervene with patients. Most recently, we're focusing very heavily on collaborative problem solving, which is an evidence-based practice for children and adolescents. We're the first hospital in the country to attempt to use collaborative problem solving methodology with an adult population, let alone an adult forensic population, and some of the early data that we're looking at there is showing a significant positive effect: less aggression, less seclusion, less restraints, and therefore less injuries. But it's early, but I think we're very optimistic. We're also focusing on trauma-informed care. Some of the other points that are mentioned there have to do with treatment planning, doing good assessments, and translating the assessments into a quality treatment plan that is focused on discharge. Behavioral health strategic plan, there are some specific things we're working on in terms of what we mentioned earlier, reducing and eliminating the civil patient wait list, reducing the length of stay for people who are civilly committed, which has a lot to do with the backdoor issue, getting people discharged when they're ready to leave the hospital, and decreasing the number of people admitted as 370 patients. So I think one of the significant things, we don't mention it enough, but we should. The hospital is one element of a spectrum of services, mental health services. It's not an island to itself. We admit people from the community because they're too ill or too dangerous to be treated in the community. They come to the hospital for treatment, they receive the treatment, and they return back to the community. So we've been working very hard this past biennium, and we'll continue to do that, to work so that there is that communication and that flow in the system. Right? As I said, we can legitimately claim now And this is remarkable, I think, after only a 5 or 6 year period, that Oregon State Hospital is at least one of the best, if not the best, state psychiatric hospital in the United States. Personally, I've worked in a lot of them, especially on the East Coast. I know a lot of the hospitals in the East, and we know the 15 hospitals in the Western states, and I don't think we take a seat to any of them, which I think all the citizens of Oregon and the legislature should be proud of. You made a great investment in the hospital system. You're making great investments in the community system, and it's beginning to show the effect that it should. So with that, I conclude.
Thank you very much. We probably have some questions for the last 6 minutes here. Senator Winters and then Senator Steinhardt, and then Representative Kenny Geyer. So we'll make
you can bring the answers back.
Senator Winters.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But because you didn't address the frequent flyers, and so that I should share the report that came from my district attorney, Walt Beglar, who actually worked with the hospital and the state police and others to address the frequent flyer issue and the number of individuals who actually were prosecuted and will probably go to DOC. So I will share that. I did share it with Senator Bates, and I will share that information with the rest of the panel. The other piece, could you bring us back later your staffing and supervisory ratio and see how that's fitting in with, our co-chair's mandate, that one. And then I am very pleased to see what's happening in the aggression and those assaults. I've been tracking that for years, and you're doing a very, very good job. But I think getting those stats, and then also your vacancies, staff vacancies, and how and the length of time that they've been vacant. And that's all I have.
Chairs Nathanson and Senator Winters, I have that right here. The staff-to-patient ratio overall is 1 to 3.27. We generally use 1.3 as the guideline there, and it's only above 3 because right now at Junction City, because we're not at the capacity yet. When we move from 3 units to 4 in Junction City, we already have most of the staff for the 4th unit. We'll just need the direct care staff for that unit. So we'll be right around that 1.1 to 3 ratio.
We have two more people waiting to ask questions.
I'll write them and send it offline.
No, please ask it, but we don't need to have all the answers.
What was it before we built the new facility? Because there should have been a change in what those ratios were because of siting and some of the others. So it would be nice to have a charting of what was it before the facility and what is it today.
Great. Okay. Great. And you can write that back to us.
Okay.
Senator Steinhardt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you go back to the slide that shows the trend line on overtime per patient, please?
Yes.
Thank you. That one. I want to make sure I'm interpreting this correctly, and you did say that you could present this information in a different way. If I understand correctly, in January of 2015, we were at about 32.5 hours of overtime per patient per month. Is that correct?
In which time are you talking about?
I'm just looking at the most recent month, January 15. If I'm reading that graph correctly.
That's for the month, yeah.
For any given patient, if you took your total patient population and your total nursing hours, you had 32.5 hours, i.e. about a 0.8 FTE per patient per month of overtime?
For that month, yes, that's correct.
So this is a longer answer than you're going to be able to give right now, but I would really like some commentary on why, if that's the case, that the staffing ratio that you hold as your benchmark is the best one, because I've got to believe that if overtime's time and a half and OPE costs, other personnel costs, are running about 25 to 30%, why it's cheaper to do that a week's worth of overtime, because for every 4 patients you have, that's one, or every 5 patients you have, that's one FTE. Help me parse through this, because I don't get the math. So that's a longer answer, and the chair is quite reasonably asking.
It's a longer answer than you want today.
I'd really like some information.
Then I would be glad
the committee
to
would
that.
Like to understand that.
Glad to
Thank
do
you.
That.
Are you both available tomorrow at roughly this time period, 8:30 to 10? Or maybe 9:30 to 10.
Representative Nathanson, I wish I could say yes, but we got word this morning that the Joint Commission has showed up to do their triennial survey.
Oh, boy.
So
have a good time.
Oh, good luck.
We'd rather be here.
Yeah.
Those of us in medicine wish you best.
We do.
Thank you. It's spring break week, so.
We were just consulting up here, wondering whether there might be time left after PSRB tomorrow to come back to a few of these questions, but we'll just catch you on another day. Representative Kenny Geyer also wanted to get a question.
Yeah, great, thank you. And just for the record, I hope that you can come back in another day and talk about something that Dr. Steve Fritz had brought up before he sadly passed away, and I'm sorry for the loss of your two employees. I know that was a big hit to your community.
Sure was.
He had raised concerns that his widow, Amanda Fritz, has continued to raise about the use of OHSU doctors, what that MOU is costing, what their work arrangements are compared to the in-house psychiatrists. So at a further date, I would love to hear more about that issue.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'll just also make a comment about it.
Thank you for raising that. So some of what we have asked you today, you will, as you usually do, send us information, and it becomes publicly available for anyone who wants to see. It doesn't have to be only an oral testimony. But we think that we can make time in our schedule to invite you to come back and visit with us at a future date. Go over some of these things that require a little more explanation or some discussion with you.
Sure.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Anything else from the committee? Senator Bates.
Good luck, the Joint Commission.
Thank you.
I've done that many, many times, Chief of Staff. Luckily, I don't have to do it anymore. But you'll be tied up for the next couple of weeks. Have a good time. Okay, you won't sleep for 2 weeks. And we'll see you when you come back after it's all over. How long do you expect them to be there with you? About a week or so?
All week. Through Friday, yes.
Okay.
Joy and bliss.
So we will not bother you for a long time. Okay, I know what you're going to go through. Okay, and those of you who haven't been in medicine, Joint Commission coming in is routine. Happens every 2 to 3 years, depending on what your last go-around looked like. But
it's not fun.
Totally takes up all your time, absolutely all your time. So good luck. And Godspeed, and hope things go well for you.
Expect to do well. Thank
you. And from my perspective, I don't expect a response back from you this week for my question because of that.
Thank you.
There's other.
Thank you.
There's other. For my question because of that.